And what I want to talk about, first of all, is women. What difference this contact made for women. Okay? And remember now, we're also comparing this to the historians who said, first of all, Indian history is inscrutable. We really can't know what the Indian history is. And the other people who said the history of Indian-white interaction is a contest in which the white people were better prepared. Okay? So that's our kind of our background in this idea of civilization and savagery, this contest view of history. Okay? Well, okay, here's a different part of that history. Okay? This is a Potawatomi woman painted by a British painter in the 19th century, a man named George Winter. What's striking about this woman, first of all, she looks pretty prosperous, pretty comfortable. Doesn't look like she's suffering and disappearing. And she's also wearing this huge cross around her neck. Okay? Now, both of these things tell us something, which I'm going to tell you more about. But the reason I wanted to show this slide, even though I'm not going to talk about her directly, I'm going to talk about one important element of this contact between Europeans and the native people of the Illinois country was trade and the women's role in the trade. You can see all of the beads around her neck and the gold medallion around her neck, and religion, Christianity. Okay. Now, the most important person in Illinois who is representative of this chapter of the Indian history of Illinois is Marie Rowenza. Marie Rowenza was a daughter of a village leader, a Kaskaskia, part of the Illinois group. Okay. Now, I should just, again, a word that you will see as you look and you're thinking about your next paper is the word Confederacy, right? Part of the Illinois Confederacy. Well, thinking back to what I said about disease and dispersion and so on, Confederacies were groups of allied villages, but they were not formally organized with written rules and regulations and so on. So Confederacy were affiliated groups of people. At any rate, she's part of this confederated, affiliated group of Illinois villages, meaning they all spoke a common language, the Illinois language. And her father was a village leader. And the Europeans who came developed relationships with leaders and called them captains. That was the French word captain, the same thing as the English. She was born about the time that the French first entered the Illinois Valley in the 1680s, about 1680. And she developed a relationship with the local priest. She was a follower of the local priest. Now, one thing that's, again, a little piece of the story that's important to keep in mind is that through archaeology and the other historical records, we know that there were a great many more women than men in these communities, and that women often had very little control over marriage partners, that parents would arrange marriages, and that there were multiple wives for men, particularly in the period of the fur trade, because women processed furs. To take a dead beaver and turn it into something you can sell requires a great deal of work of skinning and processing and tanning and so on. And that was primarily women's work, because remember there was this gender division of labor. And so a prosperous trader often had several wives. Okay? Well, that's the context. And being the third or fourth wife of a prosperous Illinois leader was perhaps less than exciting for Marie Rowenza. At any rate, she becomes a Christian early on, as many Illinois women did. And she had quite a flair for the dramatic, we know from the Jesuit priest's letters. And she would translate his teachings, his Bible stories, for the village. She would also act them out. And she also organized a group of other women who became followers of the priest, but they were more than Christians. They were really teachers. They were people who would join together to dramatize stories for other people. They would also gather together to sing and show devotion and so on. Well, she's a teenager, 1695. Maybe she's 15. Maybe she's 17. We're not exactly sure of her age. But her father, the captain, offers her in marriage to a French trader, okay, a man named Michel Coe. And he's 50 years old. And she says, you know what? I've taken a vow of celibacy. Well, this is a real problem for her father, because to have a relationship with the French traders was an important thing. Why? What is going on in this time period that would make a relationship with French traders important? Yeah? Well, it would be access to trade and goods. And what kinds of goods would be particularly useful at this time? What's happened in the Illinois Valley? Who are the unwelcome guests who keep appearing? Yeah.
The Iroquois.
The Iroquois, okay? So there's a military problem here. The Iroquois, who've been allied with other European traders in the East and who are pushing west, okay? So there's kind of a carrot and a stick. The carrot is access to trade goods tools and things that would be of European manufacture that would be attractive, kettles and pots and things like that. And there's the stick of worrying about enemies, and so wanting access to weapons, okay? Wanting an alliance, okay? So this is a real confrontation. This is like, you know, family circus. This is great, you know. Teenage daughter, father's telling her to do something, she says no, but something new is here. There's a new lever that she has, because her ally is not other women, or her ally is the priest. The priest who is a representative of French culture, French authority, the priest who has kind of status with the local traders and so on. They're kind of there, and the balance of power is not real clear between them. So it's a real showdown, and nothing happens. She doesn't marry him, father doesn't budge, and this is all from the recording of the priest, and it's somewhat self-serving because, as you see from the next point here, what happens is she says, okay, I'll marry Michel if, she says to her father, if you convert to Christianity, and if the whole village converts to Christianity. So that's what happens. She marries him. He converts to Christianity. He becomes a pious traitor. He has a reputation of being a hellraiser all across the Illinois country and that sort of thing. And so she marries him, becomes a Christian, he becomes a Christian, and the whole village then converts to Christianity. She's married to him for 7 years. After he dies, she remarries another French trader and lives for 20 years in Kaskaskia. She dies in 1725, and she's buried underneath the floorboards of the church at Kaskaskia, which says something about how pious she was, how devoted she was, how the church, if you've been to cathedrals, and you know the people that get buried in the church are the special folks. So, here is a chapter of this interaction that we don't often think of. That is, women who saw an advantage to becoming Christian, advantage because they could then have some more leverage over their situation, okay, and they could play this role, more powerful role in the community. But there's something more about her. And that is that we know she was buried under the floorboards of the church, but we also have her will. And this is a summary of the things that are in her will. Now, look at this. You're all historians for the moment. Tell me the significance of this will. You've heard something about traditional Illinois culture and village life and how they lived and so on. This is 1725. This is a document out of Illinois Indian history. What do we make of this document? You show this to a group of fifth graders or eighth graders or junior high students someday in your classroom, or you see this on a final. There's no final in this course. What do you say about this? What's significant about this document? She's got a lot of stuff, which tells us what? She's wealthy. What does that say about Indians? Wasn't poor or stupid or uninterested in trade. She was into it, okay? Accumulation here, okay? Not everybody necessarily, but this one person, very interesting. One of the things that we think about, well, it's that quotation earlier about the contest and the better prepared people and the less prepared people. It's like the Boy Scouts against the guys who didn't get to be Boy Scouts, you know. Be prepared, not be prepared. She seems pretty well prepared, right? What else can we say about this? Do I have to start calling on people individually? Or? Yeah?
It kind of seems like a plantation kind of going, kind of like they have going over in the so-called more like a civilized area.
Okay.
Just like with all the homes, with all the different dwellings and the slaves.
And cows and pigs. Now, are these... When I don't expect you to have instant recall of what you heard from me last Thursday, but when I told you about how they lived prior to the arrival of Europeans, did I mention chickens and pigs and cows?
They didn't exist.
They didn't exist. They weren't here, okay? So these are all things that they brought in. And it is like a plantation. This is a commercial farm and very quickly adapted to this stuff. Now, again, this is one person. It's not everybody. People made all sorts of choices, but her choice... pretty interesting. And then we have slaves, okay, who were a part of French colonial culture, part of English-American colonial culture, okay? And there's a whole discussion among historians. We could spend the rest of the day on what does Indian slavery mean, because Indians had this kinship society, and there are those who say, well, Indians really adopted people. They became kind of part of the family, even though they were owned. Another people, the other extreme, say, well, Indians were like everybody else. But the answer is actually somewhere in the middle, I think, where people, they didn't have the racial categories the way Europeans did. They weren't as rigidly held because there was intermarriage and so on, but they were slaves. I mean, they were people that were property, that were owned by this woman. Okay. So here we have Marie Rowenza not only getting leverage through religion and saying, you know, guess what, Dad, I decided to take a vow of celibacy, sort of taking that route around convention, but also an economic role here, okay? So you've all seen very clearly what is here that is, I think, is significant. Here is a distinctive role that women play in this new middle ground culture where they have leverage through the church, because, and again, you have to stop. If you were raised a Protestant like me, you probably have less of a sense of this. But there's the whole cult of Mary in the Catholic Church and of women saints and so on, the role of spiritual women in the church, very powerful. So women have that kind of role to kind of hook onto, or that tradition to hook onto. And then by doing that, they're also hooking into an economic system and are developing power. So across the Midwest, and I'll show you another evidence of this in a second, across the Midwest, women in this middle ground fur trade era move from these village societies, the Illinois were very prominent, but others as well, move into these positions of tremendous influence in the fur trade, primarily because they end up marrying either Frenchmen or the children of French and Indian families. So we develop what are in Canada called Métis communities. Métis is the French word for mixed. The term in the U.S. is often referred to as mixed blood, but the point is they're mixed heritage people who have evolved in this particular way, and they are a product of this particular moment.